Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing movement to declassify 28 pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 that implicates Saudi Arabia as having financed and possibly directed the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Senator Bob Graham, the former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chair of the Senate 9/11 Inquiry, joins us to discuss what is in the 28 classified pages and his efforts, along with Senators Rand Paul and Ron Wyden, who have introduced the Transparency for the Families of 9/11 Act to force the president to declassify the pages, and failing that, exercising the option that Rand Paul will read the content of the secret pages into the record with immunity on the Senate floor. Then we'll go to Beirut, Lebanon, to speak with Thanasi Kambanis, the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. He joins us to discuss the possibility of a war between Hezbollah and Israel breaking out this summer as a showdown between the self-declared Islamic State and Hezbollah looms, affording Israel the opportunity to strike Hezbollah, which is overextended in Syria, propping up the Assad regime. We will look into the extent that Iran is now in charge of Assad's military operations and the collateral benefits for Israel's Netanyahu that a war with Iran's proxy Hezbollah would scuttle Obama's diplomacy with Iran. Then finally, we'll go to Turkey to speak with Henri Baki, who served as a member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean, and is the author of Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He joins us to discuss today's parliamentary elections in Turkey that will decide whether President Erdogan's power grab succeeds in making him the president of a republic presiding over a compliant parliament, free to exercise his considerable ego and megalomaniacal ambition. And joining us now is Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He is the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Bob Graham.
Thank you very much, Ian. I appreciate the chance to talk with your audience again.
And Senator, you were on Capitol Hill this week with a bipartisan group of House members, including Republicans Thomas Massie and Walter Jones and Democrat Stephen Lynch, and, of course, Senator Rand Paul. He's sponsoring the Transparency for the Families of 9/11 Victims and Survivors Act, which is co-sponsored by Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon. So this bill will be introduced to the Senate on Tuesday. Am I right?
Yes. I'm not precisely certain when Senator Paul is going to file his bill, but if it hasn't already happened, it will happen soon. And then he has announced that he is going to offer this piece of legislation as an amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill, which will be before the Senate in the next couple of weeks, and which is one of those must-pass bills. So if he's able to get his amendment adopted in the Senate, and if the House will concur with that, then this bill is ready to go to the President for his signature.
And the bill is the Transparency for the Families of 9/11 Victims and Survivors Act is largely about declassifying 28 pages from the 2002 Senate inquiry into the causes of 9/11 that you chaired.
That's correct. It basically calls on the president to release the chapter of 28 pages from the final report of the joint inquiry conducted by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees in 2002. Those 28 pages, which deal primarily with who financed 9/11 and point a strong finger at Saudi Arabia, have been withheld since the summer of 2003. I think it's about time that the American people had the chance to know what is the full nature of the relationship with Saudi Arabia, and to ask some questions about why the government of the United States has withheld this information for so long.
Now, I take it since you generated these pages in your report that you chaired, you know what's in them, but you're bound by secrecy agreements that you've signed not to reveal the contents.
Yeah, what I have said is as far as I can go, because what I have said has been previously reported. But as to the details of the report, it's going to have to await a public airing. A number of members of Congress have recently read the 28 pages, as they are entitled to do, and they, with almost out exception, have come away with statements like, I never understood this situation to be as serious as it was. This has caused me to reassess my whole concept of what 9/11 meant, and other statements that carry that sense of urgency and the importance of what's in those 28 pages.
And I take it that the congressmen who have read these pages have to do so alone, without aides and without taking notes.
Yes. In fact, my oldest daughter, Gwen Graham, was elected to Congress in November. She has read the 28 pages and has used words similar to those I just spoke, and has now become a co-sponsor of the resolution to ask the president to release this information.
And at the end of the day, a senator or a congressman could read those pages into the congressional record, could they not? Is that...
Well, the answer is yes. Under the Constitution, a member of Congress conducting official business cannot be sanctioned for doing so. And there have been examples in the past of where sensitive documents such as the Pentagon Papers were made public by being read by a member of Congress. The Senator Rand Paul has said that he is going to try first to do this through the normal legislative channels, including the possibility of adding this as an amendment to a defense authorization bill, and use that as the vehicle to get this information out to the public.
So reading this into the congressional record would be a kind of the final act. Obviously, you and Senator Paul want to go through the process of introducing this bill and trying to get the president to sign off on the implementation of the Transparency for the Families of 9/11 Victims and Survivors Act, which Senator Paul is going to attach to the defense authorization bill.
That's correct. And I think that's a wise course, to first do it the standard way, but reserve the option of doing it the unstandard way. Now, one of the practical problems is, as you described, getting access to this chapter is not easy. And if a member of Congress wanted to read it into the record, they would have to go through some gymnastics to get a copy of the document that they could read from.
So again, I'm speaking with Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. And since you have been taking the lead on this, and now you've got some allies, one of whom is Senator Rand Paul, who's running for president. You've got also got Ron Wyden, and as I mentioned, a bipartisan group of congresspeople, including your daughter. It seems to me that there's some momentum building. You've been kind of a voice in the wilderness now for a number of years, and I take it the FBI sort of told you to drop it, and you obviously didn't take their advice. So do you feel like you're finally making some headway?
Yes, I do. There's a building number of points of attack on the 28 pages. And let me say, the 28 pages are symbolic. They are the tip of the iceberg of a massive amount of information which has been withheld from the American public on this matter. I, in the press conference on Tuesday, referred to a document about a Saudi Arabian foundation called Al-Haramin, which has been reputed to have been a significant funder of Al-Qaeda. The Treasury Department of the United States has been doing various investigations on this foundation. The lawyers who are representing the families who are seeking justice through a suit against the Saudi Arabian Kingdom and various entities such as Al Haramain have asked the Treasury Department to release the information that they have on the foundation. The Treasury Department responded by releasing 111 pages of documents on this one foundation. Every page of the document was blacked out. So that's the kind of non-disclosure and what I call aggressive deception that is being used to avoid the American people learning what was the extent of Saudi Arabian involvement in 9/11.
Well, it's always been clear to me, Senator, that the official story is very incomplete, shall we say. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of conspiracy theories, most of which are pretty ridiculous, that have kind of muddied the water. But it remains that an operation like 9/11 had all of the appearances of an intelligence operation. And you were the former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. It just seems so unlikely that a random group of people could have got together in Hamburg and pulled this off without coordination, without funding, and without an intellectual author. Bin Laden himself has not claimed responsibility. He's more or less said, I was the inspiration. And it seems to me that if these 28 pages reveal the financing, that's the place to start. I take it what you're saying is it's the tip of the iceberg. The real question is to really uncover what was a very, very well-planned and well-executed intelligence operation.
Absolutely. Implausibly to me, the official position of the United States government is that these 19 people operated alone. Who were these 19 people? Well, we know 15 of them were Saudi nationals. We know that most of them didn't speak English. We knew that very few of them had ever been in the United States. We know that many of them did not have a high school education. That their ability to come into the United States and in some instances stay here for over a year and a half and avoid detection to carry out such a complicated task as 9/11, given their limitations, it's unbelievable they could have done it on their own. I believe, and so do the chairs of both the Congressional and the Citizens 9/11 Commission, that it is highly unlikely that they could have done it without some external support. The question is, who was that support? Where did it get its funding? And what was the nature of the assistance that was provided to the 19 hijackers? Those are some of the unanswered questions of 9/11.
Well, some of them have been answered to the extent to which the two hijackers who were down in San Diego, who flew into the Pentagon, were assisted by the Saudi, a member of the Saudi consulate here in Los Angeles. And there was a highly unusual and fortuitous, to the point of incredulity, meeting where they ran into these guys at a restaurant, which, you know, what are the chances of that?
And I know a lot about that. I did a little research and found that there were 134 Middle Eastern restaurants in the Los Angeles area as of January 2000, which is when this meeting took place. I had a statistician do a probability analysis of the chances of two couples, and there was the two hijackers were one, and a man named Omar Bayoumi and his driver, Bayoumi being a Saudi agent living in San Diego, that they would have come to the same restaurant, sat close enough to each other to have heard the conversation, and then been engaged, that it was something like 4 million to 1 were the were the odds that that could occur. And yet, the FBI has said, well, we believe it was that 1 out of 4 million and that it was just a coincidence that they ended up meeting on that fateful afternoon.
And the Saudi consular official was later deported from the United States because of his ties to al-Qaeda.
Yes, he was. And I've been learning a little more about this man. His name is Thumnani. He was a religious figure in Saudi Arabia, had fairly recently been transferred to the cultural and religious unit of the Saudi embassy in Washington, and then in the same month of this meeting, in January of 2000, had been transferred again to the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles. As you've said, he subsequently was deported based on evidence that he had had terrorist links. It, again, is confounding that we would believe that those links did not lead to the fact that the Saudi agent Bayoumi and the two hijackers, Hazmi and Mitar, met, decided to relocate to San Diego and spent the better part of a year preparing for their responsibilities in 9/11.
And Hazmi and Mitar down in San Diego were set up in a residence by Omar Bayoumi, and didn't they receive funds from the wife of the Saudi ambassador in Washington?
Well, Bayoumi received funds from two sources, and the inference is that he became the conduit for financing. One was, yes, the Saudi embassy in Washington has a fund for Saudis in the United States who are in need. And one of those persons was a lady by the name of Mrs. Batnan, who had a serious medical problem. She received financing for her medical care and then was receiving funds through this Saudi relief effort for her rehabilitation. When the two hijackers arrived in San Diego, the money that had been going to Mrs. Batnan was diverted and started to go to Mrs. Bayoumi, the wife of the Saudi agent in San Diego. The inference was that this was a means of getting money through Bayoumi to the two hijackers who had also arrived in San Diego in late January of 2000. Then there was another source of income. Bayoumi had a, quote, ghost job. That is, he was on the payroll. In fact, I have just recently learned that he was the only person on the payroll of a Saudi firm called Della Avco, which did work for the Civilian Aviation Authority of Saudi Arabia. He was paid, but never expected to show up for work. When the two hijackers came to San Diego, his allowances were substantially increased, again raising the inference that these new funds that had suddenly came to him for no apparent other reason were a source of financing the two hijackers who had just become his charges and responsibility in San Diego.
And also in Florida, where you were the former governor of Florida and senator from Florida, there was, of course, the case of the Saudi family who had multiple meetings with hijackers, the 9/11 hijackers who were training to fly down there, and they disappeared before 9/11, leaving a brand new car in the driveway and food on the table. You've forced a release of, what, 80,000 pages into the hands of a judge?
Yeah, actually, there were two primary hijackers who were taking flight lessons at a school near Sarasota. A third hijacker came into the scene somewhat later. One of those original two was Mohammed Atta, generally considered to be the leader of the 19. But we have been working on this case for the last almost 5 years and have been before a federal judge with a request for a Freedom of Information Act. It's a long story, but initially the FBI said they couldn't respond because they didn't have any information about an investigation done in Sarasota. Then they said, well, we do have some information, but it is it would be an invasion of privacy to release it. Well, I ask, whose privacy? The two hijackers are dead. The family has fled back to Saudi Arabia. Just whose privacy are we protecting? So we finally went to federal court under Freedom of Information Act, and the judge pressed the FBI hard, and they eventually dribbled out about 80 highly redacted pages, and then 80,000 pages of other documents relating to their investigations of 9/11 through the Tampa office of the FBI, having said initially they had zero.
So just in closing, Senator Graham, I also should mention that Senator Gillibrand of New York, she may well sign on to the bill that Rand Paul and Ron Wyden are introducing to the Senate, the Transparency for the Families of 9/11 Victims and Survivors Act. She's under pressure from the 9/11 families, I take it, in New York.
Well, the predominant number of the victims were from the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and one would assume that the representatives of that region would have the deepest interest in seeing that justice was done for their people. I am very pleased that Senator Gillibrand has joined this fight, and I think she will be a very important figure. She's tenacious, smart, cares deeply about her constituents, and is a great addition to the effort to get the 28 pages released.
Well, Senator Graham, I thank you very much for what you're doing in the name of truth and history, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian, and best wishes to you and your listeners, and I hope the next time we talk, we'll be talking about the contents of the 28 pages, not just the fact that they are available, but under heavy lock and key.
I agree, and I thank you again, Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the co-chairman of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's the author of the suspense novel Keys to the Kingdom. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to Beirut, Lebanon to look into the possibility of a war between Israel and Hezbollah this summer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut, Lebanon, is Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City. His books include A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest, Once Upon a Revolution, an Egyptian Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And there's a couple of subjects right in your neighborhood, which is obviously there's a war right next door in Syria. But there's a possibility that things could get even worse, according to a recent article by the former National Intelligence Officer at the CIA on the Middle East, along with Dr. Trita Parsi, Paul Pillar. And Trita Parsi wrote a piece recently about the possibility of a war between Israel and Hezbollah this summer. And also there are reports that there's a showdown looming between the self-declared Islamic State and Hezbollah in the Baka Valley. So let's start with the possibility of a war in the summer between Israel and Hezbollah. Are there any rumors of war in your neighborhood in Beirut?
And those rumors are always there. The sort of specific nature of that the alarm sounded in that article, I haven't seen. We have that general idea that Israel might try and take advantage of Hezbollah's distraction to wage a war. But in terms of actual data points, I mean, the most recent thing we saw was a major drill that the Israelis did last week, I think, in which they did a sort of national air raid alert and had everyone go into shelters. And the way, frankly, that was interpreted here was as a show of readiness rather than as a saber rattling. And really, the old balance of terror calculus still pertains, which is simply that Hezbollah retains the power to be such an inconvenience to Israel in the event of a war that Israel would have to have a really high, security motivation to start one, because no matter how many fighters Hezbollah is using in the war in Syria, the thing that makes them such a difficult adversary for Israel is something very low tech. It's these Katyusha rockets that they can rain down, and most of those require very few actual humans to fire, and they still have the exact same number of people, if not more, dedicated to the Israeli border. So Israel knows, again, it's not a strategic threat that Hezbollah poses. It's this tactical nuisance, and they can do the exact same thing they did in 2006 or worse. So my read and the read of the people I talk to here is that that war, the war between Israel and Hezbollah, is not the one they're afraid of this year.
Well, your wife, Thanasi Ann Bernard, who's Beirut correspondent for The New York Times, has been writing a lot about Syria, of course, which she's been covering, and particularly the extent to which the Assad forces seem to be leaving the Islamic State alone while they pound the more secular or less extremist groups, because they obviously want to make the face of the opposition the extremists. But there are other reports that I've heard that there's been a purge within the Assad military because there are a lot of Alawite officers that are not happy about the, and particularly the Ba'athist officers are not happy about the increased control of the war by Iran, who apparently the Iranian military is essentially in charge of Assad's military operations. Does that gel with what you're hearing?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's absolutely of course, it's very hard to tell from the outside what the dynamics inside the regime are, and one of the things we're all trying to figure out is what kind of cracking points there are within the ruling family, the clique, the political clique at the top. In the security apparatus, we've already seen, we've heard from defectors, and we've heard from a couple of pretty reliable sources of this discontent that you refer to, and there's actually two different places where it lives inside the Syrian army. One is that, you know, there actually are quite a lot of non-Alawites in the army and in the security apparatus. I mean, it's dominated by the sect of the Assad family, the Alawites, but there are important Sunnis, and many of them have increasingly either voiced discontent or have been suspected of it. And we saw Rustam Ghazaleh, one of the two most important intelligence officials, was well, we believe he was killed. He was murdered. At any rate, there was an incident in which he was beaten by a rival intelligence chieftain's guards and then died of the injuries. And then the other most high-ranking Sunni in the security apparatus, Ali Mamluk, was reported to have been arrested because of his criticisms of the role that Iranians were playing in the defense of Syria. That report ran in the British press, and 2 days later, Ali Mamluk appeared with the president of Syria and a visiting Iranian official in a sort of photo op meeting. To those of us who watch Syria, that doesn't tell us anything about whether he's been arrested or not. He could have been arrested and then sort of trotted out from detention and put on display, or perhaps the report was a fake leak, or who knows. But it's clear that there's a lot of criticism from within the elite of Syria of the role that has been given, the free role that's been given to the Iranians to run affairs inside Syria. Now, to answer your other question, which is, I think, really important, there is already a war against ISIS, right? I mean, not just the U.S. war against ISIS, but there's a Hezbollah war against ISIS. And here we see a real divide between the people who are actually saving the regime's butt and the regime itself. So you have Iran and Hezbollah who say, hey, ISIS is a huge threat. It's a huge threat existentially to the whole region. These guys are crazy. They're fundamentalists. They are not going to be swayed by easy carrots and sticks. We really need to crush this Islamic State group before it gets completely out of control and entrenched. Whereas the regime in Damascus, as we've seen, is very happy to act almost in collusion with ISIS in this sort of, you know, after me the flood strategy that they followed. That is a huge source of tension that none of us can report because, you know, none of us are privy to what conversations go on between the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and their sponsees in Damascus. But that is clearly a major point of disagreement, which is going to have consequences all over the region.
And again, I'm speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who's in Beirut, Lebanon. He writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation. And his books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his latest book is Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. So in terms of the looming showdown between the self-declared Islamic State and Hezbollah, apparently the Islamic State are dug in the mountains in the border just north of Lebanon's Baca Valley, and they seem to have a pretty good strategic toehold there. How is Hezbollah going to deal with them if they're bogged down defending Damascus?
Well, that battle has actually already begun, and there's been sporadic reports of it in the Western and local press because Hezbollah actually has been inviting media on limited battlefield tours in this mountain range called the Kalamun Mountains. This is a mountain range between Lebanon and Syria. It's very strategic because it's sort of the only mountain range between Damascus and the Bekaa. So whoever controls that can really interfere with Damascus's access to the sea. And that area for a long time had been rebel controlled. And the Kalamun Mountains, to explain a little bit, they straddle the border. So they're partly in Lebanon, partly in Syria. Those mountains were, until recently, in the hand of jihadists, partly ISIS, partly Nusra. And Hezbollah decided over the winter that they were going to make it their strategic priority to clear those mountains of Sunni jihadists, because that's the area that's not only a threat to the Syrian regime, that's a threat to Lebanon's security. That's where the car bombs that were coming into Beirut were coming from. That's where a lot of the jihadists were infiltrating into various parts of the Baca Valley. So they began that's where jihadists had been coming in over the winter and attacking Christian and Shia villages inside Lebanon. So it became a really extreme threat on this side of the border. So Hezbollah mobilized in the spring, and they have cleared about half the mountain range now by their own reports, and that's the part controlled by Nusra, which is the less intimidating adversary. And now they're gearing up at this week, last week, to start their assault on ISIS there. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, this is, you know, in Hezbollah, we have the region's premier sort of urban combat, non-state actor, quasi-military force. And in ISIS, we have what's turned out to be the most formidable suicide bombing-assisted jihadist fighting force we've ever seen. And this it's a matchup that we, you know, I wouldn't dare to predict how it will go. But certainly, if Hezbollah can't succeed against ISIS in this area, that's a bad sign, because this is the most serious military effort against ISIS that we've yet seen. It's much more serious than anything the U.S.-backed coalition has done, certainly more serious than anything the Syrian anti-ISIS fighters can muster just by the low quality of their forces.
But in terms of the overall strategic picture, it would seem to me, Thanasi Kambanis, that the fact that Iran is basically propping up Assad, without them he would have fallen, and they've basically taken over the military situation and using Hezbollah as their proxy, along with the IRGC forces that apparently they're increasing. This, of course, if you broaden it out a little bit, gives a lot of the Sunnis and certainly the Israelis a great deal of pause when there's a possibility that in this deal that the P5 plus one is making with Iran, that when that deal goes through in about a month or so, if it goes through, Iran will get a windfall of up to $150 billion, where so much money is being unfrozen of theirs. So a lot of reports from the Saudis and others and the Israelis, the concern is that that money will go straight into weaponry for Hezbollah and for Assad. Is that?
I mean, look, even under the pressure of sanctions and sort of as much pressure as the West is willing to muster, Iran had, I think, no trouble mustering the amount of money and materiel needed to support the Assad regime. I mean, this is it's a little bit more than a drop in the bucket, but this is not some kind of huge strain on the Iranian treasury. I mean, so just recently, 4 years into the Syrian war, they've begun sending 15,000 fighters from Iran. And these are largely not core Iranian forces. These are sort of conscripted and trained Iraqis, Hazaras, Afghans, others who aren't part of the IRGC core. They have a lot of men at arms, and they have a lot of cash. They're an oil state, so they are able, almost not as an afterthought, but they're able quite easily to muster that kind of exponential increase in the amount of fighting men that they're able to send to Syria. They could keep this going forever if they wanted to. Okay, this is not ever going to require 200,000 troops like America sent to Iraq when it was occupying. It's never going to be that big of a commitment in order to maintain. And the truth is that the regime in Syria is a lackluster ally for Tehran. They would surely like a better client in Damascus than Bashar al-Assad. Their view of an acceptable political settlement is different than the West's, but they absolutely, if they could preserve their strategic alliance with Hezbollah through a friendly government in Damascus that was not as intransigent and absolutist and maximalist as the Assad regime, I think they would go for it. And much like the West, they don't see a better option either, so they keep backing the horse they have. And the breakthrough is going to come, I think, not because of the enrichment deal. The breakthrough is going to come when this punishing stalemate goes on for so long that all sides realize that they could, you know, basically keep on the same course they're going for another 10 years and not get a better deal, not get a better outcome. And that's when you'll start seeing horse trading over either a successor to Assad or a resolution under Assad in which he actually gives some kinds of rights and stake for the Sunni population and ends the war.
And of course, just on the surface, it would seem that a theocratic regime in Tehran doesn't have a lot in common with the secular Baathists in Damascus. But
Although there's a wild card here, actually, which hasn't, I haven't seen a lot of reporting on this, but we've been hearing about this from people. Under the tutelage of the Iranians, the culture of the Alawite majority in Syria is starting to shift, and this will have some long-term consequences. So this was, as you said, a secular Baathist, you know, Arab nationalist regime. People drink, people don't, Alawites don't really behave as a religious community. We started to see these young Alawite fighters wearing the cross of wearing the sword of Ali around their necks, adopting the sort of, you know, Ya Zainab Ya Ali religious rhetoric of the Iranian Rev Guards, Revolutionary Guards, who are training them and working with them, and you could see this as a sort of Shiitification of the regime and of its community, the community that supports it. And that, if that really sticks, and we've seen how effective Iran has been elsewhere in the region, and Hezbollah as well, at slowly but profoundly deepening the religious identity of its community, that could actually have a problematic long-term impact on Syria, because the regime's one sort of moral strength and tactical strength has come from the fact that it can say, you know, we're not religious fanatics. We are, you know, we really are whatever we are that's terrible. We are pluralistic, and we respect Christians and Sunnis and Shias, you know, everyone who's sort of secular and willing to live as let live. We're willing to let them be part of our coalition. If they become religious identified, and their militias become a religious militia, they will just become one among many, and that could really lead to the sort of inexorable Lebanonization of Syria.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Thanasi Kambanis, back to Hezbollah, and you chronicled the last war between Israel and Hezbollah in A Privilege to Die Inside Hezbollah's Legions in Their Endless War Against Israel. A lot of Israeli generals and others have talked about the fact that that war was incomplete and that they'd like to finish off Hezbollah. And, of course, the new head of the foreign ministry, the director general of Israel's foreign ministry, Dori Gold, has basically said either the IDF will have to destroy the weapons now being stored in southern Lebanon or let Hezbollah fire thousands of rockets into Israel. What would you do? I mean, there's a lot of talk about that there's an inevitability to another war, and it's just a question of Israel's time and choosing. And one of the arguments, of course, in the article that I mentioned by Paul Pillar and Trita Parsi was that the collateral benefit to Netanyahu would be that this would scuttle the Obama's diplomacy with Iran. So in terms of what the Israeli military are saying, does that gel with your understanding that you said that they're a strategic nuisance, but they did have a war and it was inconclusive, and there's a lot of presumption that they want to finish the job?
I mean, finishing the job is not something that can be done, right? I mean, they can they like to use these very inhuman metaphors in Israel to describe their sort of scorched earth campaign. So they use metaphors like mowing the grass, let's say, to talk about their repeated wars in Gaza or even their wars here in Lebanon. And the idea is that they reduce the sort of tactical reach of their adversary through repeated wars that, you know, destroy long-term rockets and other infrastructure of war. The things that really make that seem unlikely to me here are, one, that Hezbollah is a deeply entrenched entity that's actually part and parcel of the Lebanese state, and it's backed by the Syrian state and the Iranian state. So it's not a small non-state actor. And the second thing is again simply the cost of doing it. I mean, I think they would do it in a second if they thought they could bear the price in terms of the retaliation. But the retaliation is serious. These aren't the little homemade rockets that get fired out of Gaza that kill, you know, a few people who got heart attacks running to shelters. These are real rockets that, you know, in the last war killed more than 100 people, and that are aimable in some cases, and that are very close to major population centers. if now I don't know military tactics, if they can somehow figure out a way that they think immunizes them from the threat of these rockets, then I think they would do it. But to my knowledge, there is no such shield system that can protect them against these very low-tech Katyusha rockets. So that's why I think that's more bluster. Dory Gold's position that you cited is more bluster than likelihood.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thanasi Kambanis, who's in Beirut, Lebanon. He writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is a contributor to foreign policy and a fellow at the Century Foundation. His books include A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel, and his latest, Once Upon a Revolution, An Egyptian Story. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Turkey to get an update on today's parliamentary elections in Turkey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Turkey is Henri Baki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Can the Kurds Stop Erdogan's Bid for Total Power? Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Baki.
Hi, Ian.
And to answer the question that was the title of your foreign policy piece, can the Kurds stop Erdogan's bid for total power? What are the election results? They're not expected until tomorrow, but you're there in Turkey. What's your sense of whether...
The election results are out. The Kurds have managed to get into parliament. They've crossed the 10% threshold, which... was doubtful for a long time, but they passed it convincingly. And what's more important is that the ruling party, Mr. Erdogan's party, the Justice and Development Party, has failed to win a majority of seats in parliament. With 98% of the votes counted, it doesn't look like they can win a majority. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But this is a major, major defeat for Mr. Erdogan. And he wanted his party to win these elections. He technically is the president. He was not supposed to participate in the elections, but he did. And he wanted his party to win in a significant way to get 330 seats so he could change the constitution. All these dreams are now in tatters. So he's going to have to rethink and find another strategy, but I think he's gotten a major slap from the Turkish voting public.
And these are official results, and there's no way that Erdogan can reduce the vote through foul means.
It's too late. It's too late now. Everybody, including all the television channels that are pro-Erdogan, have already conceded that his party... But they're still the number one party. I mean, they're still the largest party in parliament. But considering that since 2002, in every single election that his party entered, they won a majority, and often a very convincing majority, this is a major defeat.
So,
it's always, in politics, it's always a game of expectations, right? I mean, yes, it's the largest party, but everybody expected it to win a majority. It did not. Everybody expected the Kurdish party not to make it in. It made it in. So it's an expectations game, and therefore he lost big time.
So can the Kurdish Party, the People's Democratic Party, form a bloc with the Republican People's Party and the Nationalists, Nationalist Action Party?
This is too early to tell, because the Turkish Nationalist, the Nationalist Movement Party, is a Turkish Nationalist Party whose only campaign slogan, if you want, is being anti-Kurdish. So it is strange bedfellows to put them all in one coalition government. There are many different ways in which you can have an alternative coalition to the ruling party, but I'm not going to bore your listeners with all the intricate details. But suffice it to say, it will take a few days for people to realize what happened, for negotiations to take place. Constitutionally, the president of the republic has to turn and give Mr. Davutoğlu, the new leader of the AKP, the current prime minister, the opportunity to form the next government, because he, after all, controls the largest number of seats in parliament. Now, if Mr. Davutoğlu fails, then he has to go to the second biggest vote getter. So, and this has to take place all within 45 days. So we have a period of uncertainty, a period of horse trading that's going to come up. And I think Mr. Erdogan is going to try to figure out a way to call new elections, because maybe he thinks he can reverse these results. I don't know. But he certainly has a plan B, because he's not the kind of person who takes such results lying down.
And again, I'm speaking with Ori Barkey, who's in Istanbul, Turkey. He's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University and served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence. And he's authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Can the Kurds Stop Erdogan's Bid for Total Power? So, you know, this is such an irony that this party, the AKP, and Erdogan started out really transforming Turkey in many positive ways. But then obviously power went to his head, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He's built this 1,150-room palace for himself, hundreds of millions of dollars. And his excuse now for building the palace was that there were cockroaches in the old presidential palace, which he's handed over to the prime minister. So is that the pathology here, the absolute power corrupting? I mean, for example, my understanding is the bombing that took place that killed some Kurds looks like the fingers point at Erdogan, and that seems to make a really boneheaded idea that you intimidate the opposition through these terrorist means. And then, of course, it ends up just galvanizing people, because the Kurds were so outraged at Erdogan's offhand comments about the bombing that they clearly were motivated to vote.
Yeah, I think that there were other events that solidified the Kurdish vote. Let me, just for your listeners' sake, I should say that in Turkey, you have 20% of the population, which is Kurdish, and most of the Kurds tend to be in the southeast and east of the country. But those Kurds have historically been divided between Mr. Erdogan's party and the Kurdish party. All Kurds do not vote traditionally for the Kurdish party, because they tend to be more traditional, they tend to be more pious. They've always, many of them, maybe half of them, have voted for the Mr. Erdogan's party. What happened, however, is that Mr. Erdogan has really gone out of his way to antagonize the Kurds. And there's been a major shift. And when you look at the actual results by province by province, you notice that all those Kurds who used to vote for Mr. Erdogan have shifted their alliances to the Kurdish party, because he antagonized them, because he wanted, for example, remember there was this whole issue of Kobani, the Kurdish enclave in Syria that was besieged by the Islamic State. And he wanted the Islamic State to win. He made it very clear. He almost with glee, he said, Kobani was about to fall. And that had a shock effect on the Kurds. So even those Kurds who traditionally were sympathetic to him and voted for him shifted allegiances. In the town of Diyarbakir, which is primarily Kurdish, when you look at the election results, you realize that he, you know, whereas he would get maybe half of the votes there, he got a tiny fraction of the 11 seats that that province sends to parliament. He only got one, and he used to get four maybe. So it is in many ways something that he brought upon himself. The bombing, I mean, I think it would be correct to say that the bombing that occurred 2 days before on the eve of the elections was ordered by Mr. Erdogan. I think he's not that stupid or callous. It probably was done by people who wanted to provoke something. We don't know who it is, but it had the opposite effect, of course, of further galvanizing the Kurds. But I think it would be a great injustice to say that he did it. I mean, that's not fair.
No, but I think the point is that the People's Democratic Party, the Kurdish party that got the 10% threshold, they're fairly far to the left, aren't they? And what you're telling us is that the traditional Kurds who might vote more conservatively and join the AKP joined in with, in other words, they transcended their political differences in order to send this message to Erdogan.
Right. Absolutely. You called it right.
So just in the last minute then, Henri Baki, what's your sense of whether this ego-driven, megalomaniacal fellow will take the lesson that he's been handed? Or, as you mentioned earlier, he's going to fight back. I mean, this is he's got a lot of people in the neighborhood worried, and not the least of which, of course, is the government of the United States.
Well, and that is the big worry. He's a fighter. I mean, he does not know any other way to do politics but to fight. And he could have fought this differently, but now I think he crossed a certain threshold from which he can't return. And the big worry is that he's going to try to come up with some gimmick, some crisis that will allow him to call for, again, elections, allow him to maybe invoke his constitutionally, he's the commander-in-chief of all the armed forces. So if there is an external crisis or a domestic military crisis, he could conceivably invoke those powers. But he imagines it. He'll do something else. But he cannot accept these results, because these results are actually quite dangerous for him. Had his party not gotten the supermajority, but had gotten a majority in parliament and formed the government by itself, then he could shield his people from the corruption investigations and all these things. Now, if the opposition creates an alternative coalition that gets the okay in right. parliament, then all these people who have been accused of corruption are in danger.
Well, Henri, we've run out of time, I'm sorry to tell you, but I thank you very much for joining us from Turkey.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Henri Baki, professor of international relations at Lehigh University, served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff. His latest book is Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and he has an article at Foreign Policy, Can the Kurds Stop Erdogan's Bid for Total Power? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.